to provide them with the optionality. On the
Right.
one hand, they're stressing that they see inflation cooling, and that would be the condition which would allow them to provide the accommodation that they're indicating.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if inflation were to reassert itself, they have that. Well, we said, there might be fewer than what we'd intended, and there may be none now. So
Yeah.
that's the optionality that they're counting on. But I think
Okay,
from our
Aubrey, I want to well, hold that thought, because we're going to get to that. I want to, I don't want you to have to repeat yourself, because
Okay,
you.
not a problem.
All right. Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. My special guest today is Aubrey Basdeo, Head of Canadian Fixed Income at Guardian Capital. Aubrey, welcome. It's really great to see you again. It's great to have you back on the show. I'm excited to get your read on the fixed income landscape here at the beginning of the second quarter. We had quite a start to 2024.
Indeed. And Pierre, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to join you on this. It's we had the end of 2023, we saw a significant repricing of bond markets from the peak in yields at the end of October. And at that point, indications were, if you were to interpret what the bond market was telling you, was that the Fed was looking to cut by about six and a bit times in 2024. And now, where we are today, we've had a bit of a readjustment to that outlook, and certainly some question marks around whether we could have any cuts at all at this point.
Yeah, it's kind of strange the way, the way things have gotten distorted. And, there's quite a bit of rate volatility, there's quite a bit of inflation, misreads or lagging indicators that are sort of sticky, or that look sticky, and employment has been strong. Although today, I think in Canada we had some slightly weaker employment numbers, but it's been quite a start. I think for equity investors, it's been kind of interesting, because the market has sort of ripped forward with the Magnificent Seven or the Magnificent Six, and the other sort of 493 stocks are starting to look a little bit better as well, with some broadening that's happening. I think before we get started, Aubrey, I just want to give you a little bit of an introduction. For those of you who don't know Aubrey is an absolute veteran, one of the pioneers and forefathers, really, of modern fixed income management, having had long tenures, most recently 14 years at BlackRock, as managing director of fixed income strategy, which includes his time as principal portfolio manager at BGI Barclays iShares, which was acquired by BlackRock. And prior to that, 6 years as portfolio manager and head of the Macro Rates Relative Value Fixed Income Group at Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan. And he brought all that experience with him to Guardian Capital in 2020.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Bond yields have been rising recently. Fed governors are taking some of their rate cuts off the table. They're echoing the take a wait and see approach. Are we going to get our cut on this year? What are your thoughts? And how much of this is rhetoric?
So let me address the Fed governors rambling on about the various scenarios that they see that ranges anywhere from three cuts to potentially yesterday we saw Kashkari suggested that there may be no cuts at all. The point there, I think, is to understand that the Fed is trying to have the optionality and maximize that optionality around whether they go three times, two times, or none. So listening to Powell, he thinks that they're on course for three interest rate cuts at this point. And that's, you know, based coming out of the last meeting, that was kind of the central mode. And the rationale behind that is that inflation is cooling, but they need, you know, some more time to be really confident that inflation will continue to edge towards their objective. There is a risk, obviously, that that does not happen. And so that would preclude them from doing what they, at this point, think is the path if inflation evolves and the economy evolves the way that they're thinking or they're modeling. So yes, three or two looks to us to be reasonable. And the point would be that the emphasis, I think, is going to shift from the inflation story, assuming that, you know, inflation continues to ebb towards, I really don't think 2% is the number. I think we're going to be in a world of maybe 2.5-ish is the right number. But the ebbing will continue. And to that end, we think that you will see some number of cuts, whether it's two or three. I think that's reasonable. And the messaging around that is going to be that they're simply going to be less restrictive, not accommodative. I think that's the distinction I would make here. Mm-hmm. They're very restrictive at the moment based on where inflation is relative to where the overnight rate is. And so it's just narrowing that that gap, that restrictive gap, to some more modest level. So that's the messaging I think that we will turn to in terms of the explanation for reducing the overnight rate or the Fed funds rate.
I've got this picture, you know, that you know, Chair Powell and the Fed governors are sitting around a table at a poker game, and you know, he's saying, well, I've already said this, and then, you know, Neil, you're going to go out, you're going to say, you know, there may not be any cuts this year. Like, they're sitting around because they're looking at the equity market and thinking, you know, it's really tearing ahead. There's a lot of optimism. They're expecting us to cut this many times. The bond market priced in six. We said three. You know, I've said three, Chair Powell, that is. You know, now, you know, go on CNBC or Fox or whatever, Fox Business, and, you know, whisper something else. All right. Like go and tell them, you know, it might be two, it might be zero, you know, because the market's getting a little too sure of itself. You know, we should try to temper our expectations a little bit, and then we're going to do what we're going to do anyway. But let's put some confusion into the market. that's what it seems like, right?
Well, I think that would be some maybe fall in the category of conspiracy theory there.
Yeah,
but
no,
look, it's a very different Fed relative to say Greenspan, who had very tight control over who was saying anything, and largely it was just him. The other governors or Fed presidents were not as much in the news, and everybody had to toe the line, by and large. And with
it's as though they lined up, like, you know, with Raphael Bostic and then Barkin and then Kashkari, all in sequence, you know, over the last couple of days to you know, say, oh, well, maybe it'll be this, maybe it'll be less, maybe it'll be none. And, you know, it's just very strange.
And one good, certainly given the history of the FOMC, right, that it seems a little odd to have this amount of debate outside of, you know, the huddle that they typically have. And it seems to be a little more like the BOE confab, where you have very different views being expressed by each one of the members there. I view this as being healthy, and I get to go back to the point that it's really about maximizing that optionality to give them the ability to, yes, here's a path that we would like to get to proceed on, but we need more confidence about the inflation story. And in case it doesn't happen, then, you know, we've the idea was already floated that it could be two, it could be one, it could be zero. And so
exactly. Like, as you said, it gives them optionality.
Yep.
So let's, you know, taking the tin hat off, of course, we're not suggesting there's any conspiracy going on, but you know, you can't help like envisioning, like having these visions of what's going on behind the curtain, you know, with these discussions and, you know, what they're thinking and what they're seeing. So they've decided to just basically tell the world everything they're thinking rather than just one singular path or one singular thought. So given this, I mean, with rising yields, it does start to sort of re-present opportunities for investors in the fixed income space. I mean, it felt like at the turn of the year, at the, you know, the beginning of 24 of this year, that, you know, somehow because of that rapid change that took place with the December meeting, you know, Powell's chat in December, a presser, that suddenly, you know, yields pulled back, you know, below 4%. And there was some very interesting chatter that, you know, while, you know, right now this is what the market's focused on, that there's going to be these rate cuts and, right, and that signal, you know, this very strong push in the market, in the equity market, bond investors were left feeling like, you know, that happened so quickly, I didn't get a chance to exploit the higher yield and the, you know, the capital gain opportunity in the pullback in yields. But now we're back above four. The 10 years are, you know, the U.S. treasuries are back above, you know, around 4.3, the 30 years, a little bit higher than that. So I guess my question is sort of a layup to that, but what are you optimistic about?
I'm going to draw a distinction here between what's happening in the U.S. and potentially what will happen elsewhere.
And story, Canada, of course, too, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the story in the U.S. is really pointing to American exceptionalism. Very, very strong, very healthy, strong growth. And growth looks like it's going to be above potential in Q1 of this year. And, you know, that momentum should carry through into Q2. We begin to see that the ISM manufacturing numbers indicating a bottoming out. We're back into sort of that expansion territory indicated by the headline number above 50. And so there is something definitely that is somewhat unique to the U.S. at this point that is driving that exceptionalism. And it points to policies that have been implemented that are very pro-growth and reflecting, I think, this change as a result coming out of the pandemic, that policymakers started to pursue. So the reshoring and supply chain integrity were big drivers here. The Inflation Reduction Act is one thing that is also geared towards this transition economy, making the economy more green, and the infrastructure build, et cetera. So a commitment to those things are starting to bear fruit at this point in the U.S. Unlike, for example, Europe and China, the model of which in Europe has been to have growth via export-driven policies. And that is no longer the way to go in the world that we're about to enter into. And so when you look at Europe, likelihood that they'll be easing in June and probably engineer a lot more eases than the U.S. will be. So when you look at the differential in interest rates between Germany and U.S. at this point, it's pointing exactly to that very slow growth in Europe and very strong growth in the U.S. And when you look beyond Europe, you look into China, you know, they're struggling there given that they've got, you know, real estate a real estate event that's occurring there that is going to be a drag to their economy. And in addition to which, you know, their economy is based on exports as well. And so that is going to be a challenge for them to use that as a tool to grow their economy. And so the U.S. stands by itself. So I think when we think about monetary policy, there's going to be this diversion between the U.S. and elsewhere in the developed economies. And I think Canada stands at this point, from our point of view, that June looks like when the Bank of Canada will become active in terms of reducing the overnight rate, because the data today in particular points to while we've had a positive shock, a supply shock from immigration, our economy is suffering from higher interest rates at this moment because, you know, we've got consumers who are going to be in the process of renegotiating their mortgages, and that is becoming sort of acting as a retardant to consumption in the Canadian economy. So the job growth in Canada is going to be dwarfed by what we see in the U.S. We can't expect the same number, even though that, you know, the U.S. is our biggest trading partner. It's the domestic consumption number that is going to be problematic for us going forward. Higher interest rates in the U.S. is not retarding that consumption number there, because the structure of the mortgage market, as we know in the U.S., is it's 30 years in duration in terms of when you take out a mortgage.
Right.
As we know in Canada, it could be anywhere from 1 year to 5 years that you have to go through that renewal process. So less of an impact when you see the curve shifts upwards there, at least for now, but a much bigger impact here in Canada. And that's what we're looking at this point from a Canadian perspective, that we're going to get Bank Canada easing ahead of the U.S. Fed and an interest rate differential, which is going to reflect a growth that is going to be suboptimal for us relative to what's happening in the U.S.
Yeah, I think the whole U.S. mortgage market, you know, we're next door neighbors, but, you know, the differences are vast.
Yep.
In terms of how, you know, American mortgages, how Americans get their mortgage financing and how we get it. I think that, you know, there's not only the 30-year, you know, term where, you know, you could potentially have a 30-year mortgage at 2% that you locked in 2 years ago. And as long as you never move, you'll have that 2% mortgage forever, right?
Right. Yeah.
But on top of that, I think the other thing you could say makes American homeowners more resilient than Canadian is the fact that American homeowners get to take the interest as a tax deduction on their mortgages. So, you know, you could have a $60,000, you know, annual mortgage commitment. I'm just using 60,000 as a number, but let's say you've got a $5,000 a month mortgage, or if it's $4,000 a month, it's $48,000. But then that amount that you've paid in interest in the previous year comes, you know, let's say half of it comes back to you if you're in the right tax bracket the following spring, and then on and on and on. So you know, it largely explains why American households have much more disposable income per capita than we do, because we're not getting the tax benefit of writing off the interest on our mortgages. But further, you know, so it's like a double bonus for
Americans,
you know, relative to Canadian mortgages, you know, that not only do you get to lock in these long-term, you know, rates, which most U.S. homeowners did a couple of years ago before rates took off, you're still continuing to get to write it off every single year against your income. And we, on the other hand, have maximum five-year terms. Interest rates have doubled and mortgage payments have doubled for many, or will double for many if you know, we get this, you know, pig in the python happening, you know, with the pig moving through the python.
Very slowly.
You know, very slowly, but the you're you know, that's a very big difference to point out between, you know, watching financial news from the U.S. as a Canadian, everything seems to be going on, you know, quite smoothly. But then if you turn to, you know, BNN Bloomberg, for example, from CNBC, you get a whole different story. We're in for some challenges.
Challenges,
right?
It's not, as to your point about the pig and the python, right? It's going to be a sequencing here. There'll be a few this year. I think there's a bigger number next year and an even bigger number in 2026 in terms of the renewal cycle. So to the extent that, you know, rates remain somewhat elevated, it's going to be a slow growth process because consumption numbers, just the amount of disposable income, to your point about, you know, that the difference between Canada and U.S., for the offset to that is going to be wages have to increase in a significant way to provide, to sort of negate that differential. And that is not something we would expect to see in an economy that is struggling. And so that just simply means to me that growth is going to be retarded in terms of, you know, its potential,
right,
for a considerable period of time. And I think that's where the Bank Canada has to recognize that needs to be a pivot away from the focus on backward-looking inflation numbers and assume that the slowdown in growth is going to have a negative impact on, or a positive impact on inflation, meaning that we will continue to see inflation decline over time. And so they have to switch away from that focus of the backward-looking numbers to the forward expectations around if we continue to see this profile of growth. And when you look at the employment data today, I mean, it's stark contrast to the U.S. You know, the number of jobs was a minor change in terms of the net difference. It was just we contracted by 2,000, so basically flat. So no job growth in the prior month. And the composition of which reflected that it was the lower end of, you know, the hospitality and restaurants and things like that was where the job losses were occurring. And that reflects that Canadians have less disposable income to go out and spend on these kinds of services. And that likely will only get worse because the population growth, the amount of jobs you need at least, I think, around 6,000 jobs per month to absorb the growth in the population.
Right.
And if every month you're not able to deliver that, then you're creating a higher drag to consumption, or you're creating a bigger drag to consumption because people just don't have the incomes to go out and spend. And that has a negative feedback loop overall on the economy. Now, the offset to which you could argue is, you know, there is the stuff that's going on in the U.S. I think Mexico is benefiting more so than we are at this point because some of the nearshoring is occurring more so from a manufacturing perspective in
right.
Mexico. They're benefiting a lot more than we are at this point.
They're benefiting from, you know, cheap natural gas.
Exactly.
They're benefiting from the, there's a manufacturing boom going on in northern Mexico and like Monterrey.
And right? You're having the Chinese looking to backdoor their way into the supply chain by setting up plants in Mexico at this point as well. So there's a lot more positive story from a Mexican point of view relative to Canada at this point. I think... you know, this is in Canada, you know, bad news is bad news. And the Bank of Canada is going to have to deal with that. And in the U.S., you know, good news is good news at this point, because strong employment data without inflation is really good news for risk assets at this point.
It's funny when you're talking about the bond market and, you know, if you're in the investor class, you know, being optimistic you know, some often mean has often meant, you know, that bad news is good news, right? If the economy starts to slow down, you know, at a pace that's more rapid than what was expected, then, you know, the Bank of Canada will likely have to cut rates faster. And so if you're a bond investor in any sort of, you know, longer duration bonds, you're going to benefit from that. And then so the reasons for optimism as a bond investor are reasons for pessimism as a consumer, right? it's a very twisted, you know, to ask you, I realize, like, to ask you, what are you optimistic about? You know, because you're both.
Oh, yeah. So it's
right. and the opposite is true. You know, what are you pessimistic about? You know, so as a bond investor, you'd be pessimistic if the economy came in much stronger.
No, exactly. Yeah. We typically don't embrace that, because then we see higher yields, as a result of stronger growth, because the assumption is that inflation is likely to be, more problematic than otherwise would be. So for us, it's kind of a perverse world, is that you're from an investment point of view, yields come down. So you see capital appreciation in the portfolio as a result of that you need to see a weaker economy and as a result, lower interest rates at this point. But I would caution that, or condition that outlook, by pointing out that I think that the world we're entering into is not a 2% inflation world, and that it's going to be 2.5 or between 2.5 and 3. So where the question we are asking ourselves is, where is our star, or that neutral rate that the Bank Canada will have to sort of, the Bank Canada rate will be settling in at, to keep the economy balanced in terms of, you know, not too hot, not too cold. And so if the Bank Canada was thinking around 2.5-ish or something like that, we think it's going to be higher than that at this point. So right, probably between 3, 3.25, somewhere in that zone is where we land. But that will be over time that, you know, we will be able to settle out to something like that. I don't think in this episode of an easing cycle, the Bank of Canada will be rushing to that number. It'll be because inflation will still look sticky on its way down, that they'll opt to be more cautious about easing. And ease takes some time, etc. Now, you know, I anticipate it'll be about 3 rate cuts in Canada as well, and potentially 4, because again, the economy is going to be that determines how aggressive the Bank of Canada is looking to be. But
yeah, there'll be a lot of pressure.
Exactly. And that interest rate differential, because when you look today between Canada and US, you know, to the extent that you have to pay attention to the currency as well. If you're easing and that interest rate differential gets accentuated between Canada and US, then the Canadian dollar cheapens up. You, in an open economy, the currency is the thing that tends to kind of balance out those forces. You're going to be looking at higher inflation potentially that you're importing. And so the bank has to look through that and decide whether that's a permanent thing or it's a transitory thing. And that will likely, you would want to err on the side of being cautious rather than be aggressive with rate cuts at this point.
Right. So I mean, it's that last mile of
monetary
policy hardest, right? To get from 3 to 2 or from 3.5 to 2.5 is extremely difficult. And then you run the risk of overshooting on the easing. Yeah.
And the mistake that if they're going to make a mistake, it's that they're going to be focused on that 2 number and insist that they need to get to that, rather than you're on that trajectory towards 2 and you can start to ease at that point. That's why I think the narrative will shift from try to say that they're being accommodative, but say they're being less restrictive. I think that same story applies to Canada as well.
Yeah, it makes me think of you know, a bridge too far. You know, it's they might turn around and say, well, maybe we don't need to get to the 2%, right? Maybe we just need to temper it a little bit.
Correct. And that becomes a bit of a problem for all central banks, because if you've set the level at 2 and you've been articulating that 2 number, you then have a credibility issue if you decamp from that in a very visible way. So I think they'll still toe the line in terms of 2, but, you know, it takes longer to get there. We're restrictive, and so we're very restrictive. We'll be less restrictive as a way to explain that. Because it would be unleashing chaos in a sense if you start to ease without fully explaining why you're attempting to do so. So I think that when inflation is not at your target, and when you've been insisting on that, so that's why in part the narrative as well has already shifted to the confidence around on that trajectory towards 2 at this point. Now it is. It's still a question mark, though, that if inflation, for whatever reason, remains sticky and starts to go in the other direction, that how do they balance that in the face of a slow, at least from a Canadian perspective, an economy that is slowing down. Now, the GDP data for January and the forecast for February had indicated that the economy was expanding. At a reasonably healthy clip, but the employment data for March would indicate that the economy has already started to slow down. So I think that they'll have to, when we see the numbers for Q1, it'll start to ebb into March, and so it'll be somewhat lower than the momentum was projecting for January or February.
Aubrey, is there anything? I mean, I don't know if you may have answered part of this question or some of this question already, but is there anything that you feel is being missed or misunderstood by the market, by investors? You sort of alluded to, you know, the world that we're entering, and are you referring to, you know, a regime change, first of all? And secondly, you know, what is it that investors or the market, you know, what makes you want to pull your hair out when you look at what's going on and what you're hearing versus, you know, what's going on versus what you're hearing and what you know? You know, somewhere in there, is there something that you think is being missed?
Yeah, I think so. On that point, I think the operating model that we're using when we think about portfolio construction, broadly speaking, you know, we have to put a portfolio together based on the risk characteristics that we are looking for exposure to and hedge out the ones that we don't want. But that overarching view that we start with is that the world that we're entering into in terms of how things are going to the factors that we're going to be reacting to are going to be different from those factors that guided portfolio construction for the past 30 years. So yes, definitely regime shift. And we're beginning to see that framework start to play out a bit, as evidenced by the inflation story in part. And this, what I would call, not deglobalization, but fractured globalization, meaning that, yes, there are going to be elements of globalization. People will still look to offshore in regions where they feel that the supply chain is not at risk in a significant way. And so that may be more of a near-shoring exercise that you're going to go through. But there's going to be less dependence on the usual suspects in terms of where you are going to go to outsource. The geopolitical environment is something I think that's going to get more fraught with a lot more risks that you'll have to contend with. Right. And so you're going to look at a reaction in terms of when you model out the term structure. So higher neutral rate, for example, would be one thing. The shape of the curve at the moment, you know, it's very, very inverted, and it has remained inverted for longer than it has ever been in this shape historically. So we've never seen it for this amount of duration. And typically, you use an inverted curve historically as an indication for something's going to break eventually, and you'll be looking at some sort of recessionary condition, and that will promote the easing cycle from there. That doesn't appear to be the condition that we're going to be looking at here in terms of how the curve potentially could normalize. So what does that mean? I think when we think about portfolio construction at this point and looking at, again, mapping it to this regime shift that I've just explained, 10, 20 years ago, when you were anchored close to zero as kind of the you're pinned at the lower bound of interest rates, the benefit of hedging your portfolio with fixed income had to come from long rates. So you're always looking at duration as right. the thing that protected your portfolio in case something went wrong. Today, we're looking at that as less of a driver for that sort of hedging safety, hedging exercise, not necessarily safety, but just a hedging exercise. And what we're seeing now is that the risk premium or term premium is getting built into the longer end of the curve. And we're starting to see that steepening occurring when you look from the belly of the curve on out to the long end. Eventually, the front end will come down because the Fed will ease and so will the Bank of Canada. But my key point here is that if you're looking for duration as the hedge to the portfolio, that's not going to provide it in the same way that it did, you know, 10 years ago. So for us, the belly of the curve, meaning the five-year sector primarily, is where you want to think about getting that exposure going forward. And so that's the core of our portfolio in terms of how we think about our key rate profile exposure. That's where we want to have the bulk of our exposure relative to the benchmarks that we're looking at in terms of trying to outperform right. the benchmark, but also provide the positive impact from having those exposures to a portfolio that could be stressed when, you know, risk assets look to be selling off at that point. The reason you'd want to have duration in this environment, though, is because of that tail risk. So when you need safety, so for example, yesterday, when the geopolitical risk surfaced when Israel announced or pointed out that they were going to be targeting Iran and its proxies more aggressively, we saw oil spike and we saw right. Equities sell off, so risk assets sold off, and long rates fell. So that's the condition, I think, that where it's going to benefit you, so that safety aspect. But typically, for other uses that you would have for having interest rates in the portfolio or as a hedging exercise to as that balance in the portfolio, it's not going to be long rates going forward. We think it's going to be more the belly of the curve that you'll be looking at. And right. the benefit
that makes
of
sense. I mean, that makes a great deal of sense because yeah. you're getting the yield for one.
Exactly. But, exactly. But without all that risk. Yeah.
Yeah. Without all the volatility of duration. But do you, you know, I remember we spoke last year in the fall. You know, you maintained that at that point your duration exposure was somewhere around 3, 3.5.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
I think the others came in at 5 and 7 or 8. But are you considering any sort of like strategically, which would be the long term, the you know, near long term and long term view, the belly of the curve is where you're looking at.
Right.
For the yield and less volatility. And then at some point, do you see tactically taking on duration, or is that something that's not really high on, you know, not really in your radar?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the reason why you would take on duration at some point here tactically is because the economy is cyclical. So, you know, you'll go through this expansion period and then something will go wrong and you'll go through this contraction period. So that story to us is still going to be a driver for when you think about your portfolio construction going forward. There is some suggestion that we're in a structural dynamic now, so economies are going to be less exposed to these kind of cyclical factors. We don't think so. I think that's monetary policy works with a lag, and eventually we will see a slowdown. The positive supply shock that we're experiencing in the U.S. vis-a-vis immigration, as well as in Canada, more so in the U.S. at this point, that it's going to ebb. It's not going to continue forever. And so we'll see the jobs number come down. And that's why I think it's important for the Fed to start to become less restrictive now in anticipation that that is going to be the outcome that they're looking at, say, 6 months or so from here. But we're going to, yes, at some point when we see the cyclical story starting to play out in the sense that growth is slowing and you're looking at a contraction in front of you, then that's when you would look to take on the duration risk. But it's all going to be relative to, very much dependent on where we see rates at that point relative to where we think, the neutral or the rate would need to be at for an economy that's going to be operating at a different speed. And again, if our star or the neutral rate is closer to 3, 3.25, you're going to oscillate around that number in the front end, and in the back end, the range might be between, in the U.S., for example, might be between 4 and 5 at the extremes, right, that we'll be looking at. So if we had 5, then that might be too restrictive for the economy, and then that's when tactically you'd be looking at putting on that kind of a duration risk at that point. Between here and there, though, for the story for now, I think the emphasis is going to be, as we said, the belly of the curve is where you want that exposure. And then looking at income as the principal component for the driver of returns for your fixed income portfolio. So you're going to get most of the return from the coupon you're receiving, as opposed to, getting duration as a bigger contributor to the total return from your portfolio. And
that's the thing, right? I mean, we got so used to getting our return from duration.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so little income, that now, you have to flip the script. Like, if we're in a period of higher rates for longer than we anticipate, then we might as well take advantage of the higher rates.
Exactly. Right? So for us, I mean, when you look at, where you can get a 5-6% coupon in the portfolio today in the front end,
right,
just take it. That's do that all day is what I would say.
I think strategically what happens is that, people start hearing or start thinking about reinvestment risk. What if I miss the boat on getting into the longer end of the market? And then you end up with these laddering strategies and, barbelling ideas. But now's, you're saying basically now's not the time. Now's the time to consider the shorter end of the yield curve.
Certainly we're saying the Bank of Canada will be easing this year and starting in June, given the flow of the data that we're seeing. But again, the emphasis would be that I don't think the Bank of Canada is going to be aggressively lowering the rate. So yes, the reinvestment risk, if you're in money market, for example, is more accentuated because the yield curve is so inverted. But if you go out the term structure, again, it's that 1 to 5 year part of the curve, I think, for the risks that you're taking, you're adequately compensated given that you're earning a 5% coupon, for example, in the front end. So. I think that would be our point about, thinking about mitigating some of that reinvestment risk by starting to term out there, but you're not going to go and buy the 10-year sector of the curve at this point.
Right. So in the core fixed income sleeve, strategically take a position in the belly of the curve, around 5 years.
Yep.
But tactically you could explore at some point, right? Like, so, you know, in terms of, you know, we tend to talk about core and explore for equity portfolios, but you could do the same core and explore for bond, for the bond sleeve as well.
Absolutely. And it's managing also not just that exposure where on the curve you're at, but in terms of the risk premia that you're taking on, i.e. the credit exposure that you're adding to the portfolio. What's the quality of that? Because again, you know, there's a cyclicality to the cycle. Things will slow down at some point. Some companies are going to go through some difficult times. Others are going to do well. So at this point in the cycle, we feel it's starting to, given where how much credit spreads have compressed. And again, that is a function of investors recognizing that they can earn a decent return from that coupon. And so they've gravitated to owning credit spreads. And when you look at, for example, high yield, how much they have compressed, you know, the motivation is to get as much as you can. Our view is at this point, you need to be looking at the credit quality of that exposure. So we've started to shift into very higher quality exposure. So we're sacrificing some yield in order to insulate ourselves from the potential that at some point things will slow down and we would expect, you know, risk premia spreads to start to give back some of that.
Yeah. And in the credit side, it's very important to pay attention to the fundamentals.
Exactly.
That's where, you know, actively managing a credit fund or actively managing credit positions makes more sense, because, you know, then you have the opportunity to pick and choose the situations that are the most attractive.
Attractive, right. And yeah, it's all about the relative value opportunity set that you look at when you're looking at your overall credit exposure and what sectors. There are, to be fair, you're somewhat limited in Canada because we don't have as broad an exposure in terms of our corporate names that we have. The corporate index, for example, in Canada, 50% of it is financial. So it is going to be a highly concentrated portfolio, but it's always paid to have an overweight relative to your benchmark in credit exposure over time. And so it's just a function of how much of an overweight, how aggressive you want to be relative to that benchmark, that you would think about tempering yourselves from time to time as you assess what phase of the cycle that you're in. So at this point, again, I think if Canada is looking at a slower economic profile, somewhat buttressed by, you know, the benefit of having a U.S. Exceptionalism story still playing out, we could see parts of our economy do well, parts of it struggle. And so you have to be able to identify those areas that you want to, that will do well and take advantage of that. But stress the point about it's more up in quality in the portfolio today at this point relative to how we see the data and the economy unfolding.
I think it's important also to stress that, you know, active management in the fixed income arena right now is paramount.
It is in this environment because, you know, the risks are fairly significant because the distribution of outcomes, as we've highlighted, you know, the Fed wants to have this optionality. So yes, they could do nothing. And so how does the market react and, you know, to that conclusion? And so being able to take advantage of when something like yesterday happens. So for example, if spreads blow out, are you insulated from that, or are you exposed to that? So those are sort of things that you need to take into consideration. So central banks, the key message here would be that central banks 10 to 20 years ago were incentivizing you to take risk out the curve because they had this put underneath. And quantitative easing was also part of the playbook that was being employed. So investors didn't really have to worry about backups. You know, you'd always be buying the backups. Today, that is not the playbook that they're using. And that should be clear to everybody that it's a very different playbook going forward. Speaks to the regime change story that I've alluded to in terms of how we think of what the world is going to look like. And so you need to have active management to be able to insulate yourselves against these other risks, which you didn't really need as much of 10 or 20 years ago when you had forward guidance, quantitative easing, put underlying risk assets at some point where they were very much focused on, you know, growth, the growth story being the case. Today it's about inflation and the ability to ensure that they can meet their mandate's objective of keeping stable prices under control, and so would need to either raise rates if things were to continue to go in the opposite direction.
What's an overriding thought or principle that you've been sharing or stressing across your conversations this year?
The one thing that I keep pointing out to investors is that the decomposition of your returns, and we mentioned this a few minutes ago, going forward is going to be more coupon and less duration. So that's going to be a driver in terms of where, how much risk do you think you want to take? So again, right. We think that income is very healthy in fixed income, and you don't have to go far out the curve to achieve that. So that would be the first key message that I would point out. The second is, and maybe this should come first, is that we're in an environment of higher interest rates going forward. And so as a result of that, they're, from a Canadian perspective, retirees are going to be beneficiaries of that. And so that is a good outcome for them. Right. And so savers, you know, are going to be rewarded. But for those who have, you know, in the early stages of household formation, et cetera, need to buy a house and spend on housing and things like that, it's going to be costly to do that.
Right.
So the flip side of the story that you looked at the last 10 or 20 years ago, where savers are penalized, and those who are looking, you know, as I said, you know, the household using that age cohort in household formations, we're doing so. Home prices appreciate aggressively, and the cost of housing, in spite of higher home prices, lower interest rate, made it affordable. That's going to be the flip now. Today's that's the flip side of that story.
I can't help thinking, you know, about the chief millennial complaint that's been going around for quite a while, which was that, you know, the baby boomers sort of have been on the receiving end of everything.
Every good thing,
you know?
Right?
Yeah. Every, you know, and now what you're, you know, now you're confirming that, you know, now, you know, the boomers are on the receiving end of higher rates as well, right? And millennials are, you know, getting it handed to them. So it makes a strong case for demographics as well. I mean, you know, you have this wave of, you know, demographic of, you know, and of course, you know, the baby boom demographic has pretty much, you know, the lion's share of wealth. And, you know, so when you see what's happening, you can see where you know that's causing sort of, you know, some disheartening as well.
Well, yes, there's going to be a lot of angst. I mean, we're seeing that manifest itself in the housing shortage today, and the social ills that accompany that. It will take a while for us to be able to backfill all of that. At the same time, while we have an immigration policy in Canada that continues to promote, you know, it's 500,000 this year, and that number potentially grows. There is a good, I mean, that supply shock is a good thing to have because, you know, our birth rate continues to decline. So we do want to have an economy that will continue to grow at 2% or somewhere around that level. And so you need, keep that employment population growth relatively healthy. But the adjustments that we need to make between here and there is going to take some time. And I think that that's going to be, we're going to be dealing with a number of issues around that going forward. They're good news. That's a good news, bad news story from both from a social issue point of view, but also from a growth point of view. I think that's kind of a necessary evil that we have to tolerate at this point. The wealth, I think they're definitely going to be beneficiaries. Baby boomers' kids are going to benefit from that wealth accumulation by their parents. But that transition may take some time because their parents are living longer, and so need to be the flow of funds is not going to be as immediate as you might hope.
On a positive note, no.
Yes,
we're going to be around a lot longer.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So Johnny's going to have to wait, yeah. And maybe work longer.
Yeah. Aubrey, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been really great chatting with you and catching up with you. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Pierre.